years ago. They set it up on the trunk, inside the trunk of a Dragon cargo vehicle. There's an ID. This is WS2N. Well, the one that they tested, they have these tubes. You got the solar panel in the middle, and these two tubes that are expanded. One on the left side of the panel, one on the right. It's holding everything stiff. But the way it gets like that is that initially it's rolled up. These tubes are whatever they're made of. They tend to compress, but there's pressure inside of it. So kind of like rolling up a party favor, the ones that you would blow for a birthday party. When they're released, they come rolled up in a rolled up cylinder type of setup. So that when they're released, the energy that was stored in these rolled out tubes get released, and as it rolls out, it also takes spools out the solar array that's also on a roll. So there's no hinges involved. There's no accordion effect. The whole thing just rolls out, like a roll of paper towels. So I find that interesting. A couple of years ago, they only tested it, and now they're going to be putting it on the DART mission. That'll be the first mission that it's used. So it should be interesting. They're going to need this in the future if they plan on any deep space missions to Mars, for instance. If they need a big solar, they call them SEP systems, SEP, solar electrical propulsion. They have these massive solar panels. Right now, they're developing some of them. NASA is, anyway. They're testing some that are going to be in the. You'll be able to create maybe 5 or 10,000 watts, no problem. And their goal is to go to like 50,000 watts. The more wattage you get, the better these SEP rockets or solar electric propulsion, ion, basically, they're all ion type of rockets will be. You can increase the thrust. This small ion rocket has a lot more thrust than the older ones. So I think they said something like around 4 times the amount of thrust than what would have been on many of the, there's probably about 50 of these satellites flying around Earth in geosynchronous orbit, or satellites like Dawn that went to the two asteroids, Vista and Cirrus. They had ion rockets on it, but this thing is supposed to be much more powerful. So they're starting to come a long way. You're going to need that for human transportation, not only to Mars, but eventually they plan on using it on the Gateway system as well. Gateway is going to be another space station eventually in an elliptical orbit around the moon, and that will act as a base for any incoming vehicles, either cargo or for manned missions. So they'll temporarily stop off. It'll be a waypoint for astronauts eventually going down to the moon surface, and maybe when it gets too cold down there, like what that says, they'll take off and hang out in the Gateway facility until things warm up again down there after this happens once a month. You really got 2 good weeks, and then you got 2 real bad weeks. So that's the deal on that. I was going to talk about the kilowatt. That's a little further down in my presentation, but they have a kilowatt fission reactor. I'll come back to that in a little while. But they do have an answer to that on how they're going to last on the moon at nighttime. There's one antenna. I was going to bring it up earlier, but. You had enough questions for the technical part, but this has to do with an antenna that Boeing is making, and it's a phased array, but it's flat, I mean, it's only like 4 inches thick. You know, a normal antenna that would be used for looking at a satellite would, you know, be like in one of these domes. This thing is a flat setup. I have a picture. I meant to send it to you. You Dick, I should have sent it to Roy's website. It's an interesting antenna. There we are. Already have plans of putting it on the MQ-25. That's an unmanned drone air refueling tanker that they plan on putting that on first. This, you know, has to do with the military. These drone vehicles, they need a lot of data going, you know, to and from, and they need it to be able to go to a satellite. So it's going to work off the KA system. You know, you're looking at, what, 24 gigahertz or something. You're way up there, and they need an antenna that could do this. But instead of having an array dome, this is going to be a flat 4-inch thick thing. So Boeing has built it, and it should be put on this one vehicle. They're going to test it, I think, within a couple of months. So, any questions or comments so far on what I've covered so far? This is WS2N. Okay, we'll continue on here. The kilowatt power for the moon, you know, in preparation for doing that, NASA has already given out a contract for this one company to... start developing. Actually, they've actually developed it and tested it, but they want to eventually make it to the point where they can put it into space and test it in space. But it's called the Krusty. I've covered this on the net before. Krusty stands for a kilopower reactor using a Stirling technology system. So, the heat from this reactor is going to be used to heat the Stirling engine, which is going to drive the this generator system that will be able to put out up to 10,000 watts per system. They want to be able to send like at least four of these things to the moon on one of the first bases that they eventually do set up there. They'll be able to, you know, be able to run it naturally 24 hours a day, and it would be able to keep a module or two, you know, sitting on the moon, nice and toasty. So I've covered it before, but it's still in development, and now they're looking, you know, they've given out government awards for this thing, and apparently there's one company that's involved with this. It looks like they're going to get the go-ahead to eventually... put it into space. I would imagine they're going to put it into orbit first and see how it works, but they haven't said yet. But, you know, to get that kind of power out of that, you know, I think of 10 kilowatts, you know. I got a 4K generator here. I can do my whole house, you know, conservatively, but, you know, it will do the whole house as far as I'm concerned. 10 kilowatts and then four of them, you have the capability of, you know, maybe running equivalent of a half a dozen houses on the moon. Sounds good to me. Blue Origin's approach to their lunar lander that Dick brought up earlier is to send this, what I consider right now, a cargo vehicle, but they have plans on allowing another company to put a manned vehicle on top that would also have an engine, and they'd be able to fly back to the Gateway system in orbit around the moon. But the main vehicle that lands, that would just stay there, right? From what I'm seeing, I don't think that Blue Origin is designing this thing to take off. Although they might, they haven't said one way or the other yet. They made an announcement last week. The science community or space community knew that Jeff Bezos, he's got it, owns Amazon, richest guy in the world, was going to make this announcement. And sure enough, he did. And he stood in front of it and it's going to be a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen setup. It's got a brand new engine that's been under development for 3 years called the BE7. Yeah, it's like at least three engines I know of. He has the BE3, which presently works on the new Shepherd vehicle, which is almost ready to go. I mean, just last month they had another test out in Van Horn, Texas with that one. And that's the suborbital vehicle that eventually they're going to be putting people on board. My guess is by the end of the year you're going to see that. They fly right now with one booster, and on top of that is the capsule, and that will carry up to six people. That, of course, separates from the booster when you get into suborbital space. The booster itself comes back and lands on a runway back in Van Horn, Texas. Crew vehicle has three parachutes, and it comes back and lands also in Van Horn, Texas. And that so far has been very successful. This is their 11th flight with three different iterations of the new Shepherd. But that has a BE3 engine on it, so they've got plenty of experience with that engine, which is also a liquid helium and liquid oxygen engine. So they're developing that, and then they're also developing the BE4 engine, which is not liquid helium, but liquid methane. And the BE4 engine will be used on two different rockets. It will be used on their own rocket, and it will eventually be used on the new Vulcan rocket that United Launch Alliance, ULA, will be eventually launching or someday replacing the very successful Atlas V rocket. The idea was to get away from the Russian engines. The Atlas V is still running the RD-180 Russian engines, and they will be replaced with the BE-4 engine on the new rocket called the Vulcan. BE-4 engine will also be used. They'll use I believe seven of them attached to the New Glenn. New Glenn is the rocket being built by Blue Origin, the same company that says they're going to send this landing vehicle eventually to the moon, called Blue Moon. Well, New Glenn will take its first launch from Florida, from Launch Complex 36 that Blue Origin has taken over, and that will launch in really about 2 years, 2021. It's a very large rocket. I mean, if you look at the pictures between this and the Saturn V rocket, there's not much of a difference in the height or the diameter, for that matter. Saturn V, I think, was 27 feet in diameter, and this thing is like 23 feet in diameter. So, and almost just as high. Difference is this thing is running on liquid methane and liquid oxygen. So I would imagine for 2024, they need to run some cargo flights to the moon first. They should be, according to this time schedule, by that time they should be launching the New Glenn from Launch Complex 36, and on top of that they'll have this lunar lander called the Blue Moon. They'll be able to send it all the way to the moon and land. That's the plan, and that would be a cargo mission. On top of that, the pictures that they have, they show them, they could put like four rovers on top of the cargo version, sitting on top of the whole setup, and they would be able to put them down on the ground. The rovers could ride away in any which what way. I haven't figured out why they would need four rovers in one location yet, but that's what they were showing. But I think it's just an example of their capability. But they will be able to have a lot of cargo, shipped to the moon. And eventually you'll be able to have a manned vehicle on top, which will be able, my guess, carry probably two or four astronauts. Lockheed has a similar lander that would definitely carry four. That's what they're designing. This is new from Blue Origin. Let me drop it. This is WS2. And as far as cargo, they're looking at, you know, four tons, and then for their larger version of this same vehicle, they would be able to send 7 tons to the moon of cargo, which is a lot of stuff. Now, on this engine, their landing engine, is also being built. And, you know, that's one thing about Blue Origin. They really do everything in-house. Everything's nothing subbed out. They're doing their lunar engine as well, called a BE-7. So you got the BE-3 on the new Shepard. You got the BE-4 that's going to be going on the new Vulcan rocket that Lockheed and Boeing will be buying from them to put on their Vulcan rocket. And then they'll also use the BE-7, put 7 of them on Blue Origin's own New Glenn rocket, which will be taking off from Florida. They also have this BE-7 that they say has been under development for 3 years, which is, you know, what is needed for rocket development. You can't just dream these things up and have one, you know, have something made in, you know, 6 months or a year. So it's been 3 years now. And it's a liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen rocket that's going to be able to thrust down to almost nothing. So they'll be able to control the landing, you know, unlike what happened to IL, Space IL from Israel that just had the crash landing. Their engine just pulsed as it was coming in for a landing. This one, you know, you could throttle up and throttle down, similar to what we had with the LEM. No problem. That's what you really need. But it's only one engine. That's kind of weird. I thought you'd have like two or three engines, you know, some kind of redundancy in there. But they are just showing the 1B7 engine on this new Blue Moon lander. Large tanks, large hydrogen tanks, large oxygen tanks. And one of the ways they're going to produce electricity so that people can stay on the moon longer, at least through the first night, which is 14 days, is they're going to take that hydrogen after they land. They plan on having plenty of liquid hydrogen and plenty of oxygen left, and they'll be able to use that in a fuel cell system. We haven't talked about fuel cells in a lot of years. None of these spacecraft tend to have it. None of these even large geosynchronous satellites have them. But this one has it. And they'll be able to, with fuel cells, you can produce a lot of electricity. And you can go through the nights on the moon. They'll have multiple fuel cells. So I guess if one fails, another one, you know, they'll have a backup redundancy there anyway, trying to get people through the night. Now, the theory is, let's say you land down near the southern pole of the moon, such as the crater Shackleton. There's one down there called Shackleton. They know on the bottom of these craters there's plenty of ice. So over time you'd be able to mine this ice out, bring it up, and now you know once you heat this up and it becomes water, you can throw electrolysis, you can separate them. The two, and eventually have more hydrogen for gas and more oxygen. And, you know, you could pass that through these fuel cells. Fuel cells, you need a fuel source such as hydrogen. It'll work with methane, but, and of course, you need oxygen. But that's a story on Blue Moon. One other topic I had, and that was actually two more to go. One was the Virgin Galactic Company. They're making a space, let's call it a space plane. It's called Spaceship 2. We've talked about it many times on the net. That company is run by Richard Branson, and he's come a long way. He had Spaceship One years ago, but one crash put him behind the eight ball for many years. But he's come a long way. He's developed this plane, and if you want to call it a rocket, but it's a space plane that's attached. He attaches it to the bottom of carrier jet called, the carrier jet is called White Knight 2. White Knight 2 has two fuselages and four jet engines attached to it. And it flies it up to, it will fly the spacecraft up to 45,000 feet, so you're roughly 8 miles high. And it drops it, and after it drops it, the hybrid rocket ignites, and the thing goes straight up into space. It's a suborbital deal. You know, you get up to maybe 2,500-3,000 miles an hour, and you make it to, he hopes, the Kármán line, which is, would be about 62 miles. Actually, he's happy if it gets above 50 miles, because, you know, according to one group, if you're over 50 miles at space, another group at 62 miles. So he's happy if you get above 50 miles. And then the engine cuts off, and you experience two or three, or they claim up to 5 minutes or so of weightlessness. This is the vehicle with the wings, the tail wings split, and it's like one big hinge. So half the spacecraft gets split. As it's coming through the atmosphere to slow itself down, creates a lot more drag. And then after it's through the atmosphere, it resets itself back to what looks like an airplane again, and it comes back on a runway. So he's come a long way. He's flown quite a few flights to space with a pilot and a co-pilot. And he's been flying out of California, Mojave Spaceport out there. And this last flight, he actually took a passenger up, a woman passenger, and she works for the company, and she's in charge of astronaut preparation. That's her job. So he got to go for a ride as the first passenger, see what it was like in the back of the thing. Even so, it wasn't completely, trimmed out with the interior. The idea is to put six paying passengers on every flight. So you're going to have a pilot, co-pilot, and six passengers. And they're going to get up to altitude and come back and land. But they need a nice spaceport to do this. So years ago, Richard Branson owns Virgin Galactic, made a deal with a place called Spaceport America, located in New Mexico. New Mexico had this idea 20 years ago to build a spaceport there. The deal was that the taxpayers would kick in and help build this place, which they did, but there's only a few companies that have launched out of there. I think the U.S. Rocket Company and I think Vector might have made a couple of launches, and a couple of other small companies, but the main guy that was going to move in was going to be Virgin Galactic, and he plans on running countless flights with this vehicle in the not too distant future. So this place looks like if you want to call it, looks like an airport. They have this big welcoming facility. You go inside, another area where you'll be trained pretty much as an astronaut, what all the safety features are. And that's the deal. So that's going to be their home base, Spaceport America. And now they're in the process of moving the vehicles there. The carrier plane, they call it White Knight 2. That's the one with four jet engines. And then they're going to eventually move the Unity there. Unity is the name of the Spaceship 2, the one that's going to be flying to space. He gave it the name Unity. So that will be arriving, and all the support equipment, and he's got a major problem, because he wants to move like at least 100 people permanently from California. You know, it's all about families, kids, everything. He wants to move them to New Mexico permanently to work on these operations of flying people to space. If successful, he should be in good shape, because he's got future plans of also flying out of England. Well, actually, out of northern part of Scotland. Got a contract with a place there to fly the same vehicle out of there, and also another contract in Italy. So he's already got, he's got like this factory he's building. He's building these things. And he's got two that are, in the process of being completed now. So he's got one, and he's got two more on the way. So someday in the future, if it all goes well, he'll have at least three flying vehicles taking probably countless people to space. Right now, it's about almost 600 people that have flown into space since the beginning of the space program, including the Russians. And of course, the Chinese, they launch people too, not that many. Now, by having this system, if all goes well, and he gets these other spacecraft in working order, but in no time you'll be able to double that number of people that have actually qualified to go to space. It's not orbital, but they still get their astronaut wings, if they get to a certain height. So that's the story in that, and not to be outdone, Boeing is just the other day has finished their vehicle called the Starliner, and that's right now on the way to I believe that's on the way to Florida. It just left a testing facility, and it went through all its temperature and reducing the pressure, vibration tests, acoustic tests, because their vehicle has to survive sound. The vehicle's called the Starliner. It's going to be able to carry at least four people in it, and the idea is to supply the International Space Station with astronauts. So I'm glad to see that they got their problems worked out. About 2 years ago, they had problems with a fuel leak system in their launch abort system. They have an onboard liquid launch abort system, with hypergolic fuels. When they mix with each other, they have nitrogen tetroxide and hydrazine fuel. When they mix, they instantly ignite and off you go. He's got four engines that would push the people away in case of an emergency. And those each engine delivers 40,000 pounds of thrust, and they do have to run at least one more test for that system for NASA to qualify it. So hopefully they can get that done, and then before they do that, they might still be allowed to fly a vehicle up to the space station unmanned. But a vehicle itself that could carry a crew, similar to what SpaceX did a couple months ago. They did that with their vehicle. So that's the deal on the space news for this week or so. So if anybody has any questions, comments, now would be the time. If not, we'll turn it back to Net Control to Dick. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report. Any comments or questions?
Anybody, any further questions? Give us your call letters and name right now. What was your impression of that Blue Moon device? You sound awfully optimistic about how much they're going to be using it on the moon for. They make it sound like they want to make a permanent installation on the moon. Boy, there's a lot of steps required before you could put a human being there for more than a few hours on the surface. So were you also of the opinion, Paul, when you read that section, that they seem to be forgetting about some of the fine details? K2RIW, you got a Paul?
Yeah, my guess is in the beginning, well, you know, he's designing this thing to land there. But in the beginning, you're going to need to stay for at least the daytime period, that two-week daytime period, and then, you know, worry about the night in the future. But, you know, that's what you're going to need. So that means before he could send his lander down there, you got to send, you know, some kind of, you know, maybe inflatable habitat or you know, put a module that it's going to be used for people to live in during the daytime. You know, you can't put them just on the surface and walk around in spacesuits, and that's it. You know, and you can't keep them in this one tiny ascent module that would be sitting on the top. You can't do that with two or four people. You know, for an extended period of time. You know, 2 weeks. You know, it's just not going to work out. So you're going to need some kind of infrastructure down there first. And I know Bigelow had plans on doing that. I know Boeing has an inflatable deal that they plan on using for the Gateway. Maybe they could use that for on the surface too. But they're going to need something to stay in temporarily. And then it would be okay. You know, then you could land this thing and you could, you know, you could put jumper cables essentially from the lander to the habitat to and use your fuel cells to to keep everything powered. And once you develop enough infrastructure, you know, then maybe, you know, you could make it through the night. I think a combination of everything, you know, solar panels, fuel cells, and then also I like these
repeater timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Is that they plan on sending there. They're really good, and they've done a lot of testing with it. So I could be possible, but not 2024, unless somebody pours a lot more money into coordination between NASA and these private companies.
If you're anywhere near the equator on the moon, let's say plus or minus 20 or 30 degrees from the equator, you're in that region. At high noon on the moon, the surface of the moon goes to 150 degrees centigrade. That's approximately 300 degrees Fahrenheit. No matter how you make that surface inflatable or whatever tent-like structure, no matter how you make that structure, that's going to be a habitat. When the surface all around you is at 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's the lower half of your volume around you, so to speak. The upper half is cold sky, but 300 degrees Fahrenheit without extremely good high temperature air conditioning. That's an oven. That's almost pizza oven temperature. What in the world is going to keep the astronauts from cooking? You bring your body temperature above 106 degrees Fahrenheit and you start going into convulsions and you're very close to death. 300 degrees Fahrenheit, all the surface around you. Even if you have the world's best insulation, the inside of that habitat is going to be a healthy 200 and some odd degrees up there. They don't seem to worry about those details. There's no way you can build a habitat where with all the dirt around it, all the surface of the moon goes to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and you're going to survive that. Unless you're tens of meters below the surface where the heat doesn't quite get down there. Yes, they've got these tunnels on the moon, but those tunnels aren't deep enough. They haven't been evaluated enough yet. You're going to have to send some automatic digging machines that can tolerate high temperature to dig you the hole where you build the habitat tens of meters below the surface. Over to you, Paul.
Repeater, timeout.
Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, this is thick machines weigh, you know, hundreds of tons, so that's, you cross that off the list for about 100 years. Unless you're going to eventually use the material on the moon to create your own digging machine, so that's a long way off. The lava tubes, they know that they're there. Some of them are big enough to We could incorporate a town, they say. But still, you're looking at short term. Short term is the South Pole. It's going to be daylight most of the time. And the heat, well, I don't know. You have the same problem on the space station. You have modules, and they're, it's not just one piece of metal. It's every module has got two, an inner and an outer, separated by around 4 to 6 inches. And I believe it's, I think it's vacuum between the two. I'm pretty sure. So, you don't have a big heat transfer between the two, from the inside to the outside. That's why, on a space station, they say, when it gets cold, you're on the dark side of the, in the shadow of the Earth, they don't worry about it too much. In fact, the trick is to get rid of the heat. It's so well insulated that any heat, from the human body or from the electronics that are worked on board, it's just, overwhelming. That's why they need these massive radiators outside the space station. So it might be a similar type of problem. But that's nighttime. Daytime, they have to, deal with the heat.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Canceled.
You also have the inflatable ones. They have that on the space station as well right now. The beam, the Bigelow external activity module. So that's holding up very well. It was going to go up for 2 years. Now it's up there for 3 years. Back to you, Dick.
The International Space Station is in orbit, and each orbit takes around 90 minutes. So for 45 minutes, you're in bright sunlight, and for 45 minutes, you're in the shadow of the Earth. And that can average out to a reasonable temperature. On the surface of the moon, you're going to have high noon for 12 solid days. That's 100 and some odd hours. 12 days, let me think, 24 times 12. Yeah, that's 260 hours. You have 260 hours of continuous sunlight. The surface of the moon gets to close to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. And so, if you have super insulation on the habitat on the surface of the moon, you still need extremely good air conditioning. And if that air conditioning fails, you die. So, at nighttime, when it goes to minus 150 degrees centigrade, which is, I don't know the exact number, but let me make a guess, 200 degrees below zero, by having enough battery power and heaters and a good insulation, you stand a chance to survive the cold. The hot is the hard part. The air conditioning is much more complicated. It's high temperature air conditioning, and you can't tolerate a failure. There's very little fallback, if you know what I mean. You can't have two or three air conditioning systems where one of them will do it, and if it fails, you go to another one, a backup. So surviving that high temperature on the moon is a lot more difficult than makes sense. Let me drop this. During the time the Apollo astronauts were in cislunar space, in between Earth and Moon, they were using the so-called rotobroil mode. In other words, the spacecraft was in continuous rotation. So that one side was toward the sun and the other side is away from the sun, and that rotation is like, once every minute or so. If you didn't do rotobroil, if you didn't do rotation, the side toward the sun would get to some ridiculous temperature, and you touch the skin in that area, and you would burn your hand, and the air inside the spacecraft would become uncomfortable. And there you stand a chance, because when you're in between the Earth and the Moon, and you look at all the degrees of azimuth and elevation around you, a couple of degrees is the Earth, and a couple of degrees of width is the Moon. In between is all cold sky. When you're on the Moon, one complete hemisphere that you look is towards the surface of the Moon that you're sitting on, and that surface is ridiculously hot. So that's the whole reason why every landing of Apollo was at a sunrise location, and they only stayed there for a couple of days maximum. So those lava tubes, they better be very deep, and you better be able to establish a habitat down in one of those lava tubes, very far away from the surface. If you go down, let me pick a number, 30 feet below the surface of the moon, the temperature is probably more constant down there. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Okay. And by the way, I've read minus 300 in, you know, in the nighttime on the moon, from what I've read, minus 300. But that, you know, that has nothing to do with the problem. You know, the daytime. If you have a double hull, right, to the outside, a vacuum, and then a hull. That's a tremendous, you know, insulator between the two. That's why I don't think there'll be a problem. And, you know, to give you an idea, suppose you went up there with a gigantic canopy, you know, what comes to mind is the Skylab. Remember, before the astronauts got occupied Skylab, they had problems. One of the sun shields were blown away during launch, and it was starting to get very hot inside. So the plan was to go in there with this umbrella like gadget, and you know, get inside the Skylab, and it was hot. It was like they saw it like 130 degrees, and it was really cooking. And then they pushed this umbrella like gadget through an access hole, and then they were able to open it up, and sure enough, it helped, and it brought the temperature way down inside a Skylab. Same thing there on the moon. Take this big canopy type of thing and put it over the whole habitat wherever you are, and you're never going to get any light that's going to be hitting that area. And it'll be daylight out, but as far as you're concerned, you're on the dark side of the moon.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Amount of light that's hitting the module. You know, you can come up with something like that. I don't think it will be, you know, it's going to be a major problem, but I don't think it'll be a showstopper. K2RIWWS2N.
That canopy would have to be highly reflective and tremendously larger than the habitat, so that at all sun angles, so to speak, you're in the shadow of that canopy in the habitat. I vaguely see what you're saying on that one. You might survive the high temperature, 300 degrees Fahrenheit, of the surface during the day. Okay? That canopy is going to be doing the wrong thing at nighttime, Bob Paul. When it goes to minus 300 degrees Fahrenheit in the nighttime, boy, you need tremendous numbers of kilowatts of heating to keep from freezing inside the habitat. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, the biggest problem is trying to get rid of the heat, you know, even in the space station. But with these 10,000 kilowatt fission units that have actually been developed, they've run them for tens of thousands of hours, they said, and they've done weird things. They've shorted them out, they've banged them around, and they just keep going, from what I've read. But so they're supposed to be reliable. So you put four of these things up there, you're looking at, 40,000 watts of power. It's like, that would be like having 10 of my generators, you know, that I use in my house. If there's power that you're running at the same time, you know, to keep a couple of modules, working. And that would only be the beginning. You know, you have, from the spacecraft that landed, you're also running a fuel cell system. You might be down near the Shackleton crater, near the South Pole, where you have longer days than the equator. I know all the spacecraft that we landed with people are roughly in the middle of the moon near the equator, a little north and a little south, but nobody went all the way down to the South Pole. You could send up, you know, put as many solar panels out as you want. So I think they got a shot. Back to you, Dick. WS.
Okay, I think these 10 kilowatt power supplies you're talking about, I think these are some electric generators run on, I think it's plutonium. And I know that we're running very shy of available plutonium to build those things these days, Paul. I think it's plutonium they run on, isn't that true? And aren't we shy on that because of our close down of our nuclear nuclear material processing stations?
Yes, these are not RTGs. These are not radioisotope thermal electric generators. These are true fission machines, small fission machines. That's what they are. So, I'll send you where I know we had talked about it on the net before, so I probably have older information about it, which is had all the technical stuff behind the fission part of it. They're fission machines. They're not RTGs.
Okay, whatever they use for fuel, what's the lifetime of one of those fission machines, Paul? If it starts off producing 10 kilowatts, what is it producing in 5 years?
I don't remember, but I think it's still 10 kilowatts. These are fission nuclear reactors.
Okay, like a nuclear power station on the Earth. But every decade or so, you've got to replace that fuel pool.
Yeah, I know. It all winds up in Utah somewhere, or Nevada. I don't know the details on that, but I know they'd be happy to get 5 years out of it. If I was up there, I'd be happy to get through 14 nights. Dick, we're running out of time. Turn it over to you, and then you might want to turn it over to Roy. K2RIWWS2M for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet.
You have brought up a good point, Paul. A huge canopy stands a chance of surviving the heat. And where all the zillion kilowatts are going to be required to survive the cold is still left to be solved. And too bad you don't have some huge body of water as a heat sink to absorb the heat during the day and give it back to you at nighttime. It's difficult. 73-year-old, bye-bye for now. And over for Roy to repeat the addresses if he wants to. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, thank you, Dick. Always take advantage of an offer to give the links in the email. If you want to contact me, if you have any questions, if you have any topics, whatever, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the stories that I mentioned today are listed on my website, roy.ac2gs.com. And until next week, guys, have a great week, and I'll come up with some interesting stories for next week. So take it easy. This is AC2GS, and I'm clear.
And maybe a good puzzle also. Bye-bye for now, you all. K2RIW, we're clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m., 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. System. Thank you. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater. W2YR.
The net this morning, you know, it starts at 6:30, but I had to get showered and all, so I got on about 6:45. There was 27 guys on this net this morning. I mean, that's how many guys check in.
That's quite a net. They might not get time to even get heard.
Went for about a minute, maybe or two, you know. I just give the weather, you know, and ask what my signal report is. And he's got, and I'm doing other things. I'm, you know, checking my email. I get a lot of emails from my email accounts. I'm cleaning up my email. I'm getting on to my food tracker where I track what I eat. I'm filling that out. And I'm multitasking.
Great. I wish I had time, but I'm way too busy in the morning to even think about turning the radio on.
Because my wife gets up early to take her daughter to the train station. And that's what it is. But I was getting up early before that. I used to get up at 6. The clock was up at 5:30, but I used to get up at 6, shower, and I'd be all dressed and be on the air by 6:30, get done by 7, and then after that I would, you know, get breakfast going, and then by 8 I get my niece off to the bus stop, and then from there I'd get to work.
So what else is new? You make any contacts this weekend? Europe was open up yesterday.
Was it during the day? I mean, I can't get into my ham shack because my step door, that's like our bedroom. I can get in in the morning, and maybe from like time I get home, if I get home from work till maybe 9 or maybe later if she stays in the city. So I only get a certain window I can get in there. Was it during the day, like 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon?
I think I started around 5, 5:30.